is needed. Speaking of which, Channing Murray is hosting, well, it's sponsored by Muslim Action Committee, UC Jews for Ceasefire, and the Channing Murray Foundation. Yes, indeed. That's on campus, kind of, 1209 West Oregon. It's the film Boycott. And refreshments discussion to follow. Let's see, the time on this is 5:30. Doors open and film at 6. So if I'm going to make it, I have to present a show tomorrow in my absence. That's the show Window on the World, another long-standing name here at the station. And so much to figure out. Today in downtown Champaign at Westside Park, UCIMC and Party for Socialism and Liberation, and one other icon here that I can't decipher, sponsoring Solidarity with Migrants, Resistance. This event is 1 to 3. Music and chants, 1 to 1:30, March 1:30 to 2. I don't know where the march goes around the park. Speakers, 2 to 3. So maybe if I can rise to the occasion, I can get there with a recorder. Don't discourage you from doing the same, just in case. Opinions you hear are those of the speakers, not necessarily share. The rundown, I mentioned Amy Goodman's got two things she did, a web exclusive. One is might fit with her regular Breaking the Sound Barrier essay, which I'll be playing momentarily, which is about, well, it's partially about Guantanamo, or Gitmo, as I like to call it. So the other piece she has, which would fit with that, is an interview with a guy on death row, which I don't have the fortitude to listen to yet, so I won't air it, but you can find that if you want to. She has a piece which is part two of The Guy That Runs Wayback Machine, which is a great name for the Internet Archive's way, and it's specifically on capturing government information that's being put into the Orwellian memory hole before it goes away. So that'll be the other part. And then we're going to have a reprise from Greg Palast. Haven't had him in a while. They haven't been doing an election crimes bulletin. He has an interesting thesis that voter suppression was pivotal in the election of Trump. We hear about the 6 million people that didn't show up. I wonder if he has the stats on that. I've seen an essay on this. This is an interview not with Dennis Bernstein and the regular Election Crimes Bulletin, but a producer out of Kansas City, and I'll get to a portion of that, KKFI, and that'll be the second half hour. So Radio Free Labor is going to be another, they're off working show, major players. Bob will be in with his cold. And I understand he's going to present an episode of Doug Henwood's Behind the News, which has an interview with the guy that did Red States Revolt, about the teachers' strikes that just broke out in very, you know, red states, as they're called, Republican-controlled states. Arkansas, I believe, was one of them. Kansas, maybe. So he's got a new book about grassroots organizing. So that'll be episode for the Radio Free Labor. He's going to play something about the election in Germany as well. It's a package deal. Henwood, we used to air it. It's a great show. It's on Jacobin Radio as well as a podcast, so you can find it freestanding if you want to go hear what Doug Henwood is about. He had that famous book about Hillary Clinton that had her with a pistol on the cover, if I recall correctly. Alienated a lot of people. His wife, incidentally, had a book called The Faux Feminism of Hillary Clinton. So there you go. Okay. No Mumia Abu-Jamal today, but we do have something about the incarceration nation. That is the U.S. of A. I already gave a disclaimer, so let's just hear Breaking the Sound Barrier. And we'll get pretty straight away into the interview with the Internet Archivist.
Want to save taxpayer money? Close Guantanamo. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. President Donald Trump and Elon Musk, the world's richest man, have unleashed global chaos with mass firings and funding freezes as they attempt to eviscerate the U.S. government. Musk's so-called Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, has revealed significant problems within its own operations, that is. This week, Musk's DOGE team quietly removed their top five posted cost savings after journalists found, to put it mildly, major errors, like mistaking $8 billion for $8 million, or claiming $2 billion in savings instead of $18 million. Meanwhile, one flagrant expense on the federal balance sheet, which should be zeroed out, is staring Musk in the face, the U.S. Naval Base and Prison Complex at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba. Shuttering Gitmo would save at least $500 million per year. These figures are based on dated estimates and don't include additional classified amounts. The estimate still points to enormous waste, $500 million per year to house 15 prisoners, three of whom have been cleared for release. That amounts to over $91,000 per prisoner per day. In 2022, the Federal Bureau of Prisons reported the per-person cost to incarcerate stateside was $43,000 per year, or about 0.1% of the cost at Guantanamo. Clearly, Guantanamo should be closed primarily because it's been run as a lawless offshore dark site where countless innocent people have been held without charge for decades, where the government has tortured prisoners, and where presidents from both parties have imprisoned people virtually incommunicado without due process or constitutional rights. But when viewed with the cruel fiscal logic that Elon Musk is now allegedly using to cut the federal bureaucracy, closing Gitmo is a no-brainer, except that the Trump administration has decided to jumpstart another of Guantanamo's dark chapters as an immigrant detention camp. On January 29th, Trump instructed the Departments of Homeland Security and Defense to, quote, expand the Migrant Operations Center at Naval Station Guantanamo Bay to full capacity, unquote. President George H.W. Bush and President Clinton both used the base to jail migrants. In 1991, Haitians began fleeing the U.S.-backed coup that deposed Haiti's democratically elected president, Jean-Bertrand Aristide. Between 1991 and 1993, an average of 12,000 Haitian asylum seekers intercepted at sea were held daily at Guantanamo. Three-quarters of them were forcibly repatriated to Haiti, exposing them to violence or retribution. In January 2002, as the George W. Bush administration was ramping up Guantanamo to hold prisoners in the so-called War on Terror, the late human rights attorney Michael Ratner of the Center for Constitutional Rights, CCR, speaking on the Democracy Now! NewsHour, described the conditions he encountered while representing asylum seekers in the early 1990s.
The place is really a hellhole. It's not that bad for the servicemen who have set up a sort of, McDonald's and everything else on their part of the base. But where we were, which is a remote part of the camp on a desert surrounded by barbed wire with detention facilities really in the heat and outside, it's really unbearable.
As the 1990s progressed, Guantanamo's migrant prison population swelled to 45,000, as many Cubans caught at sea attempting to reach Florida were also held there. CCR and other groups were able to challenge the post-9/11 legal black hole of Guantanamo, ensuring prisoners there accessed their constitutional rights. But Ratner's description, more than 30 years on, is still accurate. Guantanamo is now overseen by Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth, who served there as a military officer from 2004 to 5. In 2021, when he was a weekend host on Fox News Channel, Hegseth commented on Gitmo.
It's a prison without a mission at this point. You're not getting any actionable intelligence. Ultimately, these guys are not, there was no speedy process. It got mucked up very, very early when left-wing lawyers and other protections came in. You weren't getting intelligence. You weren't bringing new people in. They weren't being released back and detained properly in the countries they came from. And as a result, it's just going to continue to dwindle, whereas it could have been a great place to expeditiously interrogate, try, and, you know, execute, because we are in a war. If people we were fighting a war against, it never became that. And now it's of almost no value. Right. I mean, it's a nursing home.
Hegseth, while lamenting the lack of summary executions there, was right about one thing. Guantanamo has no value, except perhaps as a dramatic backdrop to Trump's promised mass deportations. Hundreds of immigrants have already been rounded up, shackled, and flown there, only to be then relocated elsewhere. Both Hegseth and Homeland Security Secretary Kristi Noem have flown in for photo ops, no doubt at great taxpayer expense, which should irk Musk's Doge team. CCR, meanwhile, is back in court challenging the Trump administration's attempt to restart migrant detentions on Guantanamo.
For 40 years, dating back to the early 1990s, the United States government has used Guantanamo as a legal dumping ground for its political problems.
CCR Executive Director Vince Warren said on Democracy Now,
"We are trying to make good on the failed promise of Barack Obama and Joe Biden to close that terrible facility."
If Elon Musk is serious about cutting costs, he should take a hard look at Guantanamo Bay. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
And, of course, he's not really serious. I gave a disclaimer. Let's see. What I didn't do was drop in a little mention of a local business. I won't call them a small business because I think they have a lot of artwork. So we'll hear that, and then we'll get to Amy's feature with the Wayback Machine.
Programming at WEFT is brought to you in part by Cinema Gallery in downtown Urbana, a proud supporter of WEFT. Cinema Gallery is located at 120 West Main Street in the historic Urbana Cinema and represents 52 professional artists of the Midwest. For more information, visit cinemagallery.cc or follow Cinema Gallery on Instagram.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. With this web exclusive, part two of our conversation with Mark Graham, director of the Wayback Machine. This month, President Trump fired the head of the National Archives, the agency that alerted the Justice Department of his alleged mishandling of classified documents after his first term, bringing them to Mar-a-Lago, which led to the criminal case against him. The person Trump fired, Colleen Shogan, was not director at the time of the case. This comes as thousands of government websites with information on diversity initiatives, hate crimes, vaccines, environmental policies, veterans care, and major scientific research are being taken down. Gone, according to the New York Times, are, quote, more than 180 pages from the Department of Justice, including all state-level hate crime data, and 7 pages discussing anti-LGBTQ hate crimes, and, quote, 8 pages from the Department of Interior, including several detailing environmental policy initiatives. Other removed pages include information on vaccines, environmental policies, veterans care, scientific research, and more. For more on the major effort to preserve all of this information, called the End of Term Archive for Federal Websites, we continue in San Francisco with Mark Graham, director of the Wayback Machine at the Internet Archive, a nonprofit library of millions of free text, movies, software, music, and websites. They also host all the episodes of Democracy Now! Welcome back to Democracy Now! Thank you so much for staying with us, Mark. In this part of the conversation, if you could go back, I mean, your bio alone is truly amazing, and it really sets the context for the Internet Archive, internet.org, and the Wayback Machine. Talk about IGC and everything.
Oh my gosh, you're really going back here now, tied to the 80s. Yeah. In the early part of the 80s, we didn't have the web, as we know. We didn't really have the internet, but there were a lot of people working to make online services available to help what I refer to then as purposeful networking. And so a number of us in Berkeley, California, had this idea to build a computer network for peace activists. And so we created PeaceNet and later EcoNet and evolved it into the Institute for Global Communications, IGC.org. So that's something I spent most of the 80s working on that kind of work.
And then talk about what the Internet Archive is, and specifically the Wayback Machine.
Right. Archive.org, the Internet Archive, is, as you said, it's a nonprofit digital library. It was founded by a man named Brewster Kahle about 28 years ago. And he had this appreciation that this new media, this digital media, was incredibly powerful and was going to become very important. But at the same time, it was somewhat fragile and ephemeral. And I think, you know, that intuition back then has proven to be prescient. And so he set about basically pressing record, if you will, on the web, on websites and related services. And then over time, just getting better and better and better at it. Nowadays, for example, on any given day, we add more than a billion URLs to the Wayback Machine. And we don't just archive this material and collect it and store it away. It's all available to people by just going to web.archive.org. One of our guiding philosophies is that use drives preservation. And as there's millions of people every day that use our service, experience what's there and give us feedback, then that helps us to understand how we can continue to make the services better.
Now, are you concerned? I mean, as thousands of web pages of the government are being taken down or erased, if you can talk about how the Wayback Machine and archive.org, the Internet Archive, store so much data and don't rely on cloud services from companies like Amazon, Microsoft, or Google, which control storing so much information on the Internet. And as much as we have access to now, it could be nothing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's true. We do own and operate our own data centers. They are in multiple locations, both in this country, the United States, and outside of this country. And so the material itself is physically located, copied, mirrored in multiple locations. So that's just, it's one of several measures that we take to help ensure the long-term integrity and availability of the material.
Internet Archive is archive.org. But what is internet.org? Right.
Well, internet.org is this thing that back before Meta was called Meta, it was Facebook. It was something that Facebook had created and was part of their program to help bring the internet to people all over the world by providing free access through cell phone deals. But it kind of came with a catch, and that was you got boxed into getting the view of the internet through the lens of Facebook.
So, Wayback Machine, Internet Archive, what is NARA? There have been major layoffs there. It's the National Archives and Records Administration. But if you can talk about why it is so important and what's happening there.
Well, I mean, NARA is one of the storied institutions in the United States that's responsible for, you know, helping to preserve our cultural heritage. So it plays a critical role. It obviously has much more resources than the Internet Archive does. We're a relatively small nonprofit, only about 120 staff members. And we survive through the kindness of the patrons that donate money to power what we do. And as you said, NARA, as in almost every government agency that I'm aware of, is suffering fairly significant cuts at this time. So it remains to be seen what the impact of that will be. Be that as it may.
Well, let me ask you something. How does it compare?
Sure.
How does the removal of thousands of pages from the federal government websites, how does Trump administration efforts to remove them compare to previous administrations?
Oh, well, I mean, that's something that we will get a better understanding of over time. But anecdotally, and just maybe obviously based upon what we can see, the number of websites and web pages that have been removed in the last 5 weeks is significantly more than has ever happened in any change of administrations. There's an organization, as I noted earlier, Environmental and Data Governance Initiative, which will be coming out with some reports quantifying that. Just for example, if you go to tech.ed.gov, which is a section of the Department of Education's website, and look there for PDF files. These are U.S. government produced reports, our tax dollars paid for these reports about various dimensions of education. I counted more than 300 that have been removed over the past 5 weeks. So, you know, it's we don't exactly know the extent of what has been removed, but by all accounts, it's fairly significant.
I mean, one thing we do know is that the Justice Department removed the first nationwide database tracking misconduct by federal police. It also removed a database detailing criminal charges and convictions related to the January 6, 2021 insurrection. Will these databases be preserved by the Wayback Machine?
Possibly. The databases, which might be, you know, driven by back-end interactive services, may not have been preserved in the Wayback Machine. But there were many other efforts underway and that are actually still ongoing to preserve much of this material. For example, Harvard University's Library Innovation Lab collected, about 300,000 data sets, and they're working to make those available. Multiple people took it upon themselves to archive material in bulk at scale and upload it to archive.org. It's important to note, anyone can upload material to archive.org. You just go to archive.org, and on the top right-hand side, there's an upload button. Press it, and then follow the directions. In addition to that, anyone can save a web page to the Wayback Machine through a service that we have called Save Page Now. You get to that from the right-hand side of the Wayback Machine, or simply web.archive.org/save. And we made it even easier. If you install the Wayback Machine browser extension, which is available for all the major browsers, then you can simply press a button and you can archive any web page that you happen to be looking at.
So NARA, the National Archive and Records Administration, stores not only websites, but films, books, other content. Can you talk about Internet Archive's efforts to digitize physical books and old media, such as 78 RPM, old 78 records, the legal ramifications of all of this, and where the National Archive keeps all of this, the actual physical data, and is that threatened right now?
I really can't speak to where the National Archives keeps all of their treasures. That's a great question. I should probably go try to research that a little bit. But I can tell you that the Internet Archive, with a mission, as I said earlier, of universal access to all knowledge, works diligently to acquire and digitize, if necessary, to preserve, to organize, and make available material across a whole variety of media. And you named a few of them. So, for example, books. We acquire and digitize somewhere around 1 million books a year. We've digitized, I think, close to 8 million of them so far. We make these available in a variety of ways, depending upon some rights issues associated with those books. We archive academic papers at scale. We have a service called scholar.archive.org, and you can search for papers by their DOI, digital object identifier, by their title, etc. We archive television news from around the world. For example, when Russia attacked Ukraine, we decided to begin archiving four Russian television news channels 24/7. We archive Iranian news, Belarusian, Ukrainian, etc. We've been donated massive quantities of microfiche and microfilm material by universities and others, and have, for example, some of that included the FBIS, the Foreign Broadcast Information Service, or DTIC, Defense Tactical Information Center material. You mentioned 78s. The Boston Public Library donated more than 400,000 78s to us. 78s, in case people don't know, that's what happened. That's what came along before vinyl. And they were these long playing records made out of shellac that spun around at 78 revolutions per minute. They were popularized initially, I think, in the 1890s and fell out of favor in like the 1950s. After we acquired this material, we digitized all of it and make some of it available. You did ask me about some of the legal challenges, and it's been fairly well reported that we were sued by Hachette et al., four of the world's largest publishers, over a practice of controlled digital lending, which is a library practice of making a digital copy of a paper book that it owns available, one copy at a time, with digital rights management. We lost that case. We appealed it. We lost that. And as has been well documented, we decided not to take that to the Supreme Court. You can read about all of the things that I'm talking about through blogs that we publish at blog.archive.org.
And I should also say, you have all 29 years of Democracy Now! As we celebrate our 29th anniversary at archive.org. If you could also talk about how the internet began. Tell us what DARPA is, why years ago, the joke about Al Gore saying he invented the internet.
Well, okay. Different people tell different stories about that. The DARPA, Defense Advanced Research Project Agency, was instrumental in helping to fund some of the initial work that helped to bring about the internet as we know it. Through the development of standards, protocols like TCP/IP and others, and then later it became much more useful when people like Tim Berners-Lee, for example, created HTML. And HTTP and the standards that we use to publish on this platform called the internet. People like to make fun of Al Gore. Al actually did have a fairly significant role, I think, in that time behind the scenes and helping to bring about government support. In the early days of the internet, I remember I had a 56 kilobit connection that I paid for out of Stanford University, and I had to sign a contract. It was called an acceptable use policy, an AUP. And at that time, you had to actually sign a document that said that you would not use the internet for commercial purposes in order to get connected to the internet. So that was back then. Things have changed a little bit since then.
Let me ask you about archiving social media posts. Earlier this week, Senator Elizabeth Warren asked X's CEO to recover more than 24,000 deleted posts from William Pulte, I don't know if I'm saying his name right, who Trump has picked to head the Federal Housing Finance Agency.
Interesting. I didn't know that. We archive much of the public web, as I've said, and that includes a lot of social media. So we don't get everything. We don't pretend to get everything. There's far, far too much. But, we do get a lot. So I can't comment specifically on whether or not we would have that particular material. It's a constant battle and effort to try to preserve this material, to try to even understand what's there. And I'm not just talking about within the United States, right? I'm talking globally. So in all the different languages and all the different platforms that exist. And it's extremely challenging to do that for a whole variety of reasons. For example, the rise of paywalls and login prompts make it very challenging. More and more news, for example, is behind paywalls. And so that makes it inaccessible to us. We don't consider that to be public. We consider things that you can get to without a paywall or a login to be part of the public web. And at the same time, this media is very fragile, and it's much of it just simply disappears. In 2024, Pew Research came out with a report, and they looked at a particular data set of web pages from 2013, and then looked at that in 2023, and they found that fully 38% of the pages in that particular data set were no longer available on the public web. Now we got in contact with Pew. They shared their data with us. We worked to replicate much of their efforts, and we found that more than half of that material we had, in fact, archived in the Wayback Machine. That, on the other hand, there was a fair amount that we simply hadn't gotten.
That's really interesting. I mean, I remember before the internet, and then as the internet developed, librarians around the country, really considered the freedom fighters of our time, really concerned about access to information, were saying everything should be downloaded because who knows how it will be changed or deleted. Now, that was way back then. What about the role of librarians and archivists today? Because people are working at universities and all over the country right now to ensure that we have access to information and it's not subject to the whims of the ideology of a particular administration or, you know, or social platform owner or, you know, a cloud owner.
Right. No, that's important. I mean, this, you know, web archiving and archiving in general, it's a team sport, and there's room and need and opportunity for many, many different people to contribute to this effort in a whole variety of ways. I've already mentioned, for example, anyone can use the Save Page Now feature. So if you see something, save something. You may be the first person to see a particular web page, web resource, and save it to the Wayback Machine, and then it might disappear moments later. Like what happened just a couple of weeks ago with a particular web page on the CDC website related to bird flu. You know, you asked about the role of librarians. There was a librarian down at Stanford, Quinn Dombrowski, and she started an effort called SUCHO, Saving Ukrainian Cultural Heritage Online. And I remember when she started, it started as a call to join a Zoom session one day. And I think there were maybe 10 of us on the Zoom. And within a week or two, she had more than 1,000 volunteers organized, gathering information about material in Ukraine, representative of the cultural heritage of Ukraine in museums and libraries and other places that was at risk, and began efforts to digitize that material if necessary, and also to acquire the born digital material that was available on the web, literally as the bombs were dropping and buildings were being taken out and web services were being taken down. So because of that librarian's effort with SUCHO, much material was preserved that is now simply lost.
And Mark Graham, can you talk about your interventions in, for example, the European Union talking about artificial intelligence, talking about AI?
Sure. Yeah. You know, the EU is considering a new regulation relative to AI, and that's a topic of great interest to libraries in general, right? I mean, you know, the role of a library is to help, one of the roles at least, is to help a society be educated and to have citizens be armed with information necessary for them to fully participate, and to use tools, available tools, to maximum efficiency. And these days, that includes artificial intelligence. I think we need all the help that we can get to help address some of the critical issues of our time, whether they be climate change or pandemics or the threat of nuclear war, et cetera. And so the Internet Archive is very interested in helping to bring about ways in which AIs can be levered with the best that humankind has come up with, the best books, the best material. But this has to operate within a rights respecting environment, and it's got to be something that is has regulations associated with it, so that people understand what can be done and what can't be done. That's not the case, for example, now in the United States. This is by and large being played out in the court. So because things are, these conditions are not clear in the U.S., you have various players that are taking actions, and then they may or may not be sued. In the EU, at least, there's efforts underway to bring about some regulations to establish what the ground rules might be. So the Internet Archive just this week published a paper with some of our recommendations about this. And I won't go into the details. It's about an 8-page paper. But if anyone was interested in learning more about our position on this topic, they could go to blog.archive.org and they could read a blog post and then link to our position paper.
Mm. And finally, if you can talk about what you think are the biggest threats to the Internet Archive today.
You know, I tend to think more about opportunities. You know, you see like the bread and pupper poster behind me with yes, I think part of our culture here at the Internet Archive is to try to be helpful, to try to be the best library that we can be. So I think maybe, you know, a threat, which is really more like an opportunity, is that we maybe are not able to fully realize our potential and to meet the need that people have to be able to collectively come together to preserve our cultural heritage, not just for these times, but truly for all times. But it's something we're committed to, and we're grateful for the 150,000 plus patrons that help support our efforts, and we're grateful for the people that simply use our service and get benefit from it, and then maybe tell other people, hey, there's this thing called the Internet Archive, and you can get Democracy Now! Episodes there, or old time radio, or missing U.S. government webpages.
And I just visited Bread and Pop up in Vermont, so I appreciate your what's behind you, the yes and the flower.
Yes.
Mark Graham, I want to thank you so much for being with us, director of the Wayback Machine at the Internet Archive. And folks can go to democracynow.org to see part one of our conversation. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us. Want to save taxpayer money?
Yeah. That got kind of nerdy, but I can deal with it, and DARPA was big here. The internet was hatched online, but this was a node, I guess I'll say it that way. All right, I've got something from Greg Palast, I promised. I haven't previewed much of this. I'm going to excerpt the introductory remarks. This was done at KKFI out in Kansas City, by a gentleman of a certain age, I think probably close to mine. We're going to go through some of that introductory stuff. People, regular listeners, know Greg Palast, P-A-L-A-S-T, look for it. And you might want to read the article that's associated with this thesis that he has, that maybe some of those 5 million people that didn't show up at the last election were included in the long-standing tradition of voter suppression. He claims it was pivotal in the last election. So there you go. Hope I have the right spot queued up here. Bob Pelesny will be in with a solo version of Radio Free Labor, including something from the author of Red State Revolt about that sort of somewhat wildcat teachers' strikes and public worker strikes that happened in Republican-controlled states a couple of years ago. But he's got a new book out on organizing from below, I'll call it, to be pithy and to get on to the next segment.
But my fellow American reporters who are, you know, math phobic, that's why they went into journalism, never actually sit down and say, well, what happened with all that vote suppression? How many votes are actually lost? And that's what I did here. And I've done in my books, some of many people have written, you know, I've written some bestsellers, Best Democracy Money Can Buy, Our Madhouse, Billionaires and Ballot Bandits. These go through the details of the, what we call vote suppression. And vote suppression is just a fancy word for America's dark little secret. It's that unlike other democracies, we're the only major democracy in the planet which removes millions of voters from the voter rolls on purges. We're the only democracy on the planet which disqualifies ballots, not by a few, but by millions. We're the only democracy in the world which disqualifies votes and voters, and especially voters of color. And that is the key to Trump's victory. So here's the line. If you go to gregpalace.com, you can read a report called Trump Lost, Vote Suppression Won. Here are the numbers. And so let me give you some of those numbers. If it were not for vote suppression tactics, which I will detail, Kamala Harris would have won by 3,565,000 votes, over 3.5 million votes, which would have given her a popular vote victory by over a million. And she would have won four states, Wisconsin, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and Georgia. This is a very careful calculation. I work with the ACLU, NAACP, and Rainbow Push, other groups. And I go into federal court with these numbers. So I get examined pretty damn well by the vote suppressors themselves who object to my taking this into federal court with these organizations like the NAACP. So here are some of the numbers. How do you get to 3.5 million? Well, we start out with a number of tricks that keep Black people and other people of color and young people off voter rolls. The first is the purge. We're the only nation in the world that just simply crosses people off voter rolls. Now, the number, I'll tell you what, here's the guess. How many people were knocked off the voter rolls in 2023 without any damn good reason by government? And the answer can be found right in government files. We have an agency of the federal government called the Elections Assistance Commission. They keep track of not only our votes, but our non-votes. And what they recorded is that 4,776,706 voters had their registrations canceled without any good reason. Okay? That's almost 5 million voters X'd off the rolls. In August, this is 3 months before the election, we already know that 317,886 voters were challenged. This is a brand new thing. We'll get back to this, where individuals, this is not the government, challenges your vote. A third of a million voters, 3 months before the election, the group that was the Trump organization that was in charge of this vigilante vote thing, I'll discuss it later, was aiming for 2 million by election day. NAACP said they got 200,000 challenges in Georgia alone by election day, stopping people from voting. We'll have to go through that because that's brand new. 2,120,000 voters who cast their ballots by mail had their ballots thrown in the garbage. Now, what? Yes. If you vote by mail, you're playing ballot bingo roulette, because even NPR, National Petroleum Radio, will tell you they did a study and they found that 13.8%, that's 1 in 7 ballots that are mailed in, are disqualified. Now, how do you disqualify a ballot because you mailed it in? The answer is there's all kinds of tricks when people are out to get rid of your ballot. So, for example, you write Spencer Graves on the outside of the envelope, but you registered as Spencer G. Graves, and because you left off your middle initial, out goes your ballot, and you don't know it. Usually you don't know. Now, spoiled ballots, that's ballots that are literally cast, not counted. Provisional ballots, we'll get to that. 1.2 million provisional ballots rejected. Now, if it were random, who would care? It wouldn't affect the elections. If all these voters are removed and ballots disqualified, if it were random, who cares? But as a statistician, I can tell you it ain't random. So let's look at mail-in ballots. I told you that NPR said that 14%, one in seven ballots don't get counted. Mail-in ballots never get counted. And that's pretty much what I got from the Elections Assistance Commission as well. It's not random. According to the state of Washington, which did an analysis in their state, if you're black, you are 400% more likely to have your ballot disqualified and not counted than if you're white. 400% more. Now remember, it's not a small amount. It's one in seven ballots. But if it's overwhelmingly voters of color who are shunted, whose ballots are disqualified. Now that's the beginning. There's also, I told you, mail. So that's mail-in ballots in Washington state, which is probably has the least vote suppression of any state. The United States Civil Rights Commission did an analysis of whose ballots were rejected. Now I told you about something called spoiled ballots, over 500,000. 585,000 in this election. Whose ballots were they that got rejected? Ready for this? The United States Civil Rights Commission. This is not just coming from Greg Palast. I use the government figures. According to the United States government, if you are black, the chance your ballot will be rejected is 900% higher than if you are white. How do you get your ballot rejected? Well, I can tell you that my sister, who is a lawyer, got her ballot rejected in San Diego because she put an X next to a candidate's name instead of filling in the bubble. And they used that to knock off her ballot. She's a lawyer. But usually it's black people. Again, the chance is 9 to 1 that if your ballot's been rejected, you're black. Okay. Provisional ballots. What the hell is a provisional ballot? If you're white, you may not even know what it is. A provisional ballot is what I call a placebo ballot. That is, you think you voted, but you haven't. So you walk in and you've been purged off the voter rolls, or you've been challenged. We'll go through that in a second. And you say, what do I do? They say, no problem. Your name's on the voter rolls, or we don't like your ID, or we just don't like you. So here is a provisional ballot, a paper ballot, with an envelope, you fill it out, and the little old lady behind the desk always says, don't worry, they will look at your registration, and when you find out you're registered, they'll count your vote. No, they won't count your vote. Professor Palast is telling you right now, according to the United States Elections Assistance Commission, again, this ain't just me, Greg Palast, it's what I get from the government. They say that 42.3%, that's nearly half, of all provisional ballots are rejected and thrown in the garbage. Because if you ain't registered, because you've been purged, you're purged. The only thing you can do is you literally have to go into your county voting office, your clerk's office, and prove you're a citizen, show all kinds of forms of ID, and then they'll count your vote. But if not, they ain't counting your vote. So roughly half of all provisional ballots are thrown in the garbage. Now, again, if we're random, hey, who cares? But I told you two things. I told you that the chance your ballot would be rejected, that your ballot would be rejected is 900% higher if you're black than if you're white. Now, who gets these provisional ballots? Again, according to the United States government, which tracks it, if you're black, if you're Hispanic, if you're Asian American, the chance you will be shunted to a provisional ballot is 300% higher than if you're white. The chance is 3 to 1 that if you're black, Hispanic, Asian, you will be shunted to provisional ballot. And again, half of those are simply not counted. And then let me just hit you now with the worst thing that happened in 2024. Because we've had purges, we've had mail-in ballot rejections, we've had provisional ballot games for years. But something new happened in 2024, which is the vigilante vote challenge. That is, for the first time since 1946, there was a mass challenge of voters of color in this nation, not by the government, but by individuals. In other words, Greg Palast can say that Spencer Graves does not live in Missouri, therefore he shouldn't be allowed to vote there. Now, who is Greg Palast? I'm not a government agent. Who am I to say that Spencer can't vote? Well, if I fill out a piece of paper in your dear state, which is an old slave state, and so you have these leftover Jim Crow laws. If I say Spencer can't vote, baby, you can't vote. Your ballot won't be counted. You have to then, now, well, what do you do about it? Well, let me tell you, in my film, Vigilantes, Inc., talk about, you'll meet Major Gamaliel Turner, African-American career military officer, U.S. Army. He's the Pentagon's expert on what's called warfare of the future. He lives in Georgia. He basically works out of Fort Benning, Georgia, but he was assigned by the military, by the Pentagon, to go to California, to Fort Hueneme. And just before the election, he says, "Where's my ballot?" And they said, "Well, Mr. Turner, you've been challenged. We can't send you a ballot." He said, "What do you mean I've been challenged? What does that mean?" A Republican Party official, his name is, by the way, Alton Russell. This GOP official, not a government official, sent in a list of 4,000 voters in Columbus, Georgia, almost all of them black soldiers out of the Fort Benning area that were in Fort Benning. He never met any of these people. He just challenged 4,000 people. Again, he is a Republican Party official, not a government official. They told Turner, he said, "Well, what do I do?" They said, "No problem. Just, you know, come into our office, prove you're a citizen, prove your address, and we'll give you your ballot." And he said, "Wait a minute. I'm 2,700 miles away working for the U.S. military. Now, why am I being told that all I have to do is fly 2,700 miles to prove I'm a citizen? This military officer that prove I'm a citizen again?" And why do you say again? Because his father was the co-founder of the Southern Christian Leadership Conference with Martin Luther King. So this is the guy that they blocked from voting. But by the way, he went 5,000 miles round trip ultimately to get his vote counted. He had to go to federal court with a lawyer to get his one vote counted. The other 4,000, again, you have loaded with black soldiers. They couldn't vote. And you'll see in my film Vigilantes when I confront, by the way, I confront Alton Russell, the vigilante GOP official, who, by the way, you'll love this when you see the film, dresses like a vigilante. He literally with a six gun, you know, pearl handled six gun, cowboy hat, the whole thing. He likes to pretend he's Doc Holliday. I'm not making this up. You'll see it in the film. He thinks he's vigilante Doc Holliday. And Major Turner confronts him and says, "You know who I am?" "No." "Well, you challenged my right to vote. You challenged my right to vote." And he got this list from a Trump front organization. Now you can watch this all. I also confront a GOP official, works for Marjorie Taylor Greene in Georgia. She challenged, you ready for this, Spencer? She challenged 32,000 voters in Cobb County, Georgia. 32,000. She didn't know who they were. Again, she got this list of 32,000 names from a Trump front group. She doesn't know who these people are. In fact, I showed her photos of her neighbors, black neighbors whom she challenged. She didn't know. I said, "Do you know who these people are?" "Oh, I don't know." "Well, you challenged their right to vote." She says, "Well, I can't call 32,000 people." "No, you can't, but you challenged their right to vote." So that's what's going on. This is the ugliest new thing. And it was at least a third of a million. And and their announced goal was 2 million to challenge the Trump organization. There's a little bit about this in the New York Times about vigilante vote challenges. They made it sound like there were three or four challenges. There were a third of a million challenges by August, a third of a million challenges. And this was last used. These individual self-appointed vigilante challenges that was first used in 1940, in fact, last used in 1946 by the Ku Klux Klan in Georgia. And the Ku Klux Klan incorporated itself to try to slither out of what is clearly an illegal activity. And so they incorporated themselves as Vigilantes, Inc. And that's why my film, my documentary is called Vigilantes, Inc. And you can stream it for absolutely nothing. Go to GregPalast.com. Greg Palast.com. G-R-E-G, you see my name, G-R-E-G-P-A-L-A-S-T, GregPalast.com. Jamie Foxx and Leonardo DiCaprio have put up the money so that you can stream it for nothing. And I'm not asking you to watch a movie. I'm telling you to watch a movie. I mean, come on, just grab some popcorn and watch a movie and learn this stuff. You don't have to sit there and do, I did all the calculations for you. You don't have to do nothing. Just meet these interesting people and watch me confront and watch Major Turner confront this guy using these Klan tactics from the GOP. And again, I'm not picking, by the way, I'm nonpartisan. I don't pick on one party. It's just that in this election, these racist tactics are used by guess who? And, you know, for those who've read, you go to gregpalast.com, subscribe, you'll get my columns, which come out not very often. You only get bugged about once every other week with a column and with an investigative report. You know, I've done investigative reports on the Democratic Party for BBC television when they were messing with the vote. For Democracy Now, when they were messing with the vote, the Democrats. So I'm not just picking on Republicans, but in the 2024 race in November, it was the Republican Party which went on a crusade to eliminate black voters from the voter rolls, to challenge them, to stop their votes from being counted. That's what happens. And I've given you the calculations. And by the way, for those who are paying careful attention using a pencil, you'll note that all the ways that I said that you can shoplift a vote or block someone from voting adds up to millions and millions. So there's some double counting. Not everyone's going to vote for, would have voted for Kamala Harris, et cetera. So taking out all the double counting and all the error in there, it comes out to 3,565,000. I'm telling you that as a statistician who works with the Justice Department and goes into federal court with these numbers. I ain't fooling around because I get cross-examined on this stuff by the bad guys when I'm in federal court. So I have to do this analysis, but I want you to see it in an entertaining way. The woman who challenged 32,000 people, when I confronted her with her neighbor's photos and asked her about how she came up with 32,000 names. By the way, you wonder how they put in 32,000 names. They don't write it out. The Klan used to have to write out every name. The new Klansmen don't have to do that. They use spreadsheets instead of white sheets. And they simply submit a spreadsheet with tens of thousands of names, thousands of names. It is unbelievable what they are doing, and that's blocking people from having their vote counted. So that's the beginning. That's the core. I'm sorry to have filibustered there, but I wanted to give you the full Monty. So you know what that is about, numbers and about racism. And racism, it's systemic racism. It's not about not liking black people. It's not liking the color of their vote. It's not the color of their skin. And that's why they go after the reliably Democratic vote, despite what we heard about, some young black men switched to Trump. That's true, but that's minuscule. They know when you're black, you're blue.
Okay. So in 1980, Republican Christian conservative Paul Weyrich told a religious roundtable, "I don't want everybody to vote. Our leverage in election goes up as the voting populace goes down." So you've got several books, I guess, that gives a lot of the history of this sort of stuff.
Yes, including Paul Weyrich's speaking to the Christian Coalition. He's saying we don't want people to vote. Of course they don't. If you let everyone vote in America, the Republican Party would basically blow away like a bad dream. But so would the Democratic Party, because if you let everyone vote, you'd have a very different Democratic Party. Don't forget that. That's why you often have the Democrats. Now, here's Republicans go after minority voters. Democrats go after minority voters because their battles are within primaries. So, for example, I did a report for Democracy Now! On how Bernie Sanders got shafted out of his win in the state of California in the primary. And I went through the numbers. They have a very peculiar primary system in California to make sure that T.O. Bernie didn't win. They knocked out so many Hispanic folks. They used a trick. I won't go into the whole story now, but they use an amazing trick.
You can find that whole story. That's a pretty much untold one. Machinations by the DNC. Okay, that was Greg Palast on a show called Media Democracy by Spencer Graves. You heard him maybe at the very end. That was a filibuster by my friend Greg Palast, who I guess will be back with the Election Crimes Bulletin that he typically did with Dennis Bernstein and Flashpoints after they get through with their fundraising. Okay, there is a march rally this afternoon in Westside Park, Resistencia, in solidarity with migrants. Show up for our migrant community. Your presence matters. Chance music 1 to 1:30, March 1:30 to 2, speakers 2 to 3. So I'll try to make it for that last hour myself, 1 to 3 this afternoon in Westside Park. Also tomorrow at Channing Murray Foundation, a film called Boycott, discussion afterwards, doors open 5:30, film at 6. Hopefully I can get it together to make it to that. Channing Murray, Muslim Action Committee, and UC Jews for Ceasefire are sponsoring that film and discussion. It's 1 o'clock straight up. Let's have another underwriting announcement, and then I'll turn it over to Bob, who's riding solo today.